Good day, beautiful people, and welcome to the Total Disclosure Podcast. Today we'll be discussing the International Spying Agency, Black Cube Intelligence, also known as BC Strategy Limited. Black Cube Intelligence is a private intelligence agency based in London, Tel Aviv, and Madrid. The company was founded in 2010 by former Israeli intelligence officers Dan Sorella and Avi Yanus. Its employees include former members of Israeli intelligence units. Black Cube provides intelligence, evidence, and advisory services in multi-jurisdictional legal and white-collar crime cases. That's how they promote themselves, at least. Black Cube is also notorious for exposing fraud, bribery, money laundering, corruption, and asset dissipation. The company has uncovered high-level corruption in Italy, Panama, and Mexico. But Black Cube's tactics have also resulted in several international controversies. In Romania, two of its employees were convicted of criminal charges involving harassment and hacking. The firm drew widespread condemnation for its work surveilling and assisting with efforts to slander the reputations of women accusing Harvey Weinstein of sexual violence and journalists reporting on them. In essence, the group will do anything for anyone as long as they pay up. So whatever notion they want to put on people that they are some sort of crusaders against crime and corruption are severely misguided. They will do anything to make the bucks. It doesn't matter if it's ethical, it doesn't matter if it's in favor of criminals like Harvey Weinstein. As long as they can pay for the services, they will be serviced. In the ranks, there's a lot of controversial characters, including Efraim Halevi, the former head of Mossad. He also headed the National Security Council and the Hebrew University Center for Strategic Studies. The board also includes people like Mer Dagan, who is now deceased, who was also former head of Mossad and honorary president of the board. We have Johanan Danino, a former Israeli police commissioner who served as chairman of the Migdal Insurance Group. Major General Yehora Eiland, former head of the Israeli National Security Council, headed the IDF's operation branch and IDF's planning branch. We have Robert Amai, former head of anti-corruption, proceeds of crime, and international assistance of the Serious Fraud Office, or SFO. Brigadier General Matti Leshem, recipient of the 1997 Israel Defense Prize. Paul Reniers, former partner at Price Waterhouse and author of GARP, Generally Accepted Risk Principles. Itiel Mayan, member of Microsoft's Customer Advisory Board. Interesting. Microsoft. Lieutenant Colonel Golan Malka, former Vice President Marketing and Business Development of NICE Systems. All these people are associated with Mossad or Israeli defense agencies in some shape or form, except for the Microsoft guy. I have reasons to believe that Black Cube Intelligence is behind a number of people and a number of psychological operations, also known as LARPs, trying to confuse and redirect the attention of investigators, researchers, and journalists as far as crimes involving human trafficking, Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, NXIVM, the Clintons, and of course some murders that were planned as suicides, just like Chris Cornell, Chester Bennington, Anthony Bourdain, or Isaac Cappy. In fact, I very much think Gabe Hoffman and Dean Carr. Dean Carr is the director for the documentary that was never released, The Silent Children, are both involved with Black Cube Intelligence. And I will make my case about that later, because at this time I have chosen to restrict how much I release about that information, because I believe it's a hot potato. It will not only compromise my security more than it is right now, but it will also make me more of a target for censorship, before I'm able to release the film, Louder Than Love, about Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington. Now, nobody wants that. My idea, the best way I can tackle this problem, is by releasing that information with the film, or within days of the film. It's not what I would like to do. I would like to disclose it right now. In fact, I had that podcast written weeks ago about the Silent Children. I recanted the episode because of this situation, because of what I found out. I had already written some of it, but as I was doing some more research on the people behind the project, I found out a lot of shady things. Things that made me realize that this project was probably never meant to see the light of day, or it was something else entirely, as it was promoted, and I'll explain that later. But there's a very big chance The Silent Children is something far more dark than we know. And there's also a chance, and I'll go with that. How do I put this? I don't think Chris, Chester, or Anthony were involved in the project in any way. Now, were they involved in exposing human trafficking and child sex trafficking? Yes, they were, beyond a doubt. Did they have some information in their possession about this child sex trafficking rings, like a black book, like a secret snuff film, maybe called The Silent Children? Yes, they did. And that's being used as a psychological operation now. And sadly, and one of the main culprits of making that psychological operation popular. I have been forced to recant myself in that aspect, which is a big aspect of my documentary. That's how the preview that I released 2 years ago, 45 minutes long, a mashup of videos, which is, it's not even a documentary, it's just like a promotional cut. It includes the official trailer for The Silent Children. That's how I promoted my work, that I was going to expose not only Chris's murder, but his involvement in this documentary. And now, I have to get a grip and realize that I was played, that the people that played me, maybe they didn't know they were being played as well, or maybe they did, and they're part of it. But all I can say is that it's so hard to trust people nowadays. Even those who are doing great things by exposing some criminals and some crimes, they seem to be protecting other criminals and other crimes. Myself, I don't think I'm protecting anybody. I mean, I protect myself, I protect my family, I protect my girlfriend, who is the person I love the most in the world. But I don't have any interest in protecting anyone, much less a criminal, much less a pedophile. Because you see, there are crimes in which I really don't have a big problem with. A crime is a crime. It has to be prosecuted. But I think some laws are beyond corrupt. Now, some crimes like pedophilia, human trafficking, murder, rape, blackmail, satanic ritual abuse, conspiracy to commit murder, all those things, they should be punished with the full extent of the law. No exceptions. So for now, only you who are subscribed to this podcast know the truth. Now, I will save the full extent of the truth as a strategy to be able to pace my work better. Because I have suffered so many inconveniences already. I really don't have the patience for more shit, you know? And I'll figure it out. And of course, you subscribers will learn about it first. But please know that The Silent Children, you know, as far as being a project Chris Cornell, Chester Bennington, and Anthony Bourdain were involved in, is a hoax, a psychological operation. And I'll tell you why. The man that originated that theory first was not anti-lawyer of Crazy Days and Nights. No, it wasn't him. He did the best to promote it. And that's why I took it and ran the ball with it. And Jamie Deluxe did. And Chris Taylor, or Mr. Self-Destruct United Kingdom, did as well. It was Gabe Hoffman, the producer of An Open Secret, notorious for having me shut down and having others shut down. and for protecting Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and other people like John Podesta and Tony Podesta and Bill Clinton and
Steven Spielberg, David Geffen. The list goes on and on and on. I mean, do you think a guy that sends t-shirts, Mossad t-shirts, to people that he pays a fee to make videos, to slander and stalk people like me, Fiona Barnett, Tiffany Fitzhenry, and other SRA survivors is trustworthy? Gabe Hoffman is a snake. Most of you people wouldn't know who he is because he's a nobody in the big scheme of things. His documentary is well known. It's very well made. He's not the director. He sued the director. He went after Amy Berg, who allegedly didn't promote the film enough, which enraged Gabe Hoffman. But in reality, I think that was a reaction by Amy because of Gabe Hoffman threatening and basically blackmailing Evan Hansen, one of the main victims portrayed in An Open Secret. But if you think for a second that a guy that spends close to 90% of his time going after other researchers, discrediting Pizzagate, saying it's debunked, or going after QAnon, those who believe in the Q movement as far as, you know, the existence of the deep state or elites involved in child sex trafficking, organ trafficking, and adrenochrome consumption and trafficking as well. Let's make something clear here. QAnon doesn't matter what you think about it. It has brought a lot of truths, and also there's a lot of disinformation in it. You gotta take the good and keep it, and take the bad and discard it. If you're not able to do that, maybe these things are not for you. While researching and sharing your findings with friends, family, you have a responsibility to echo the right information and discern disinformation from the real thing. That's a responsibility each of us have. So at this time, because of the constant issues I've encountered while exposing people like Gabe Hoffman, I have not and will not in the foreseeable future publish the information I have on him, because it's not that worth it. The guy is dedicated to take people like me down. He already cost me my Twitter. He cost me one Facebook page. He cost me my Patreon and almost close to $8,000. He cost me my PayPal account, which of course cost me money as well, because they kept like $400. Do I really have the bullets, the ammo, the firepower to take on a billionaire one-on-one when I can't even make more than $1,000 a month with the work that I do? I can't, and this is the reason why I have to do things the way I'm doing them. This is the reason why I have to pace myself better, and this is why, as much as I would like to give you the information right away, some of it will have to wait. So continue with Black Youth, and I'm sorry to get carried away, but you know, this is an important point because Black Youth is notorious for being involved in psychological operations, and this psychological operation affects every one of us who care about Chris Cornell and what he was working on. This is a report written by Max de Haldevang, geopolitics reporter, on March 11, 2019. It's titled, "Read Israeli Spy Firm Black Youth's Secret Pitch to Clients." Quote, "The Israeli security firm Black Youth has become infamous for its alleged dirty operations campaigns, which involve getting dirt under clients' adversaries. Past campaigns have reportedly involved tracking Harvey Weinstein's accusers, secretly recording opponents of Hungarian autocrat Viktor Orban, and spying on former Obama administration officials who negotiated the Iran deal." So, covering for the interests of Israel, of course. However, the company makes no reference to any of this in pitch documents for prospective clients seen by Quartz. In a pitch email, advisory board member
Kirill Paranov, says the company uses proven battle-hard methods and utilizes its board, which he notes has included former Mossad spy chief Ephraim Halevi as a member, and his late Mossad predecessor Meir Dagan as president. The only two news stories cited in a three-page attachment to the email are from 2013 and 2015, before Black Kiev was implicated in a spate of controversial dealings. The company's operatives, who include former Mossad agents, allegedly use false identities to get close to their targets and create fake companies to provide cover as they seek out evidence of financial or sexual impropriety and other embarrassing information. Black Cube and its clients can then decide how best to use the information, some of which end up in the press. In the case of Weinstein, Black Cube reportedly also surveilled journalists in an apparent attempt to stop them from publishing stories about his alleged sexual misconduct. There is no mention of such methods in Paranov's email or the pitch document. Instead, the document makes vague references to services, including identified your opponent's vulnerabilities, interests, priorities, and strategy, and having a proactive approach involving several unique methods, especially in the social engineering field. One subhead, ominously titled Identifying Misconduct and Developing Leverage, discusses finding evidence of criminality and using it to maximum effect through courts or authorities. Black Cube declined to comment to courts for this story via a letter from its lawyer. Paranov didn't reply to messages left on his cell phone. Paranov says White Chew U.S. law firm Quinn Emanuel is one of several elite law firms which Black Cube has long-standing working relationships with. Paranov is a former managing partner of the Moscow office of Los Angeles headquartered Quinn Emanuel, currently ranked as the 12th most prestigious U.S. law firm by Bolt.com. A spokesman for Quinn Emanuel declined to comment on whether the firm had ever hired Black Cube, saying only, quote, Paranov left Quinn Emanuel in October 2017, having been managing partner of a one-lawyer office. The document also cites two case studies of work it has done for clients. One details how it helped a multi-billion dollar American firm resolve a dispute with an Italian partner by finding evidence the Italian company had bribed the chief arbitrator. The description of the case closely matches one involving U.S. insurance firm Amtrust, which has acknowledged hiring Black Cube for that dispute. The Wall Street Journal reported that Amtrust later hired intelligence operatives to spy on its critics in the U.S., apparently causing the firm great embarrassment. Amtrust denied hiring investigators to pursue its critics but declined to tell the Wall Street Journal whether its lawyers or others hired by the firm had done so. Amtrust didn't reply to an email request for comment from Quartz either. The other case study details an asset recovery case in Brazil, Central America, and the European Union. The document touts the firm's employees as a selected group of elite intelligence community veterans who are able to work in any environment and have a unique mastery of cultures and languages. Paranov's email tags of their proven battle-hard methods. However, this group of intelligence veterans has also shown a propensity to be exposed in embarrassing ways. Most recently in what the New York Times dubbed the case of the Bumbling Spy, a former Israeli security official previously linked to a case with a Black Cube connection was outed by the Times and an Israeli television show as having pretended to be a wealthy Parisian investor to get a meeting with a Canadian cyber watchdog. When confronted by Associated Press journalists who had been tipped off about the meeting, Aharon Almogazulin bumped into chairs and circled the room while trying to flee, the Times reported. Black Cube denied any involvement in the incident, and the Times said did not directly answer multiple questions on Mr. Almogazulin's role. Quote, Black Cube is the only company in the world to practice human intelligence gathering on a major scale, which means we believe that the real information exists within people and we have the methodology and experience to extract it in legal and admissible ways, Paragraph claims. Blackkeef operatives have admitted to acting illegally in the past, however. When two of its agents were arrested for hacking and spying on Romania's anti-corruption czar, the firm initially denied any wrongdoing. Later, the agents admitted to the hacking in a deal with authorities that saw them go free, according to the New Yorker. In response to Quartz's request for comment on this story, a lawyer representing Blackkeef strenuously denied that the firm engages in illegal activity. A British parliamentary committee alleged in a report last year that Cambridge Analytica engaged Blackkeef to hack Nigeria's now President Muhammadu Buhari. Based on testimony from whistleblower Christopher Wiley and another unnamed source, Wiley seemed to at least partially walk this back in later US Senate testimony, saying, quote, "When I was there, we didn't have a contract with Blackkeef." Asked if he had since learned of Cambridge Analytica hiring Blackkeef, he gave a slightly cryptic response, quote, "I've become aware of a relationship that the company had with former members of Israeli security services," quote. Cambridge Analytica CEO Alexander Nix, who had earlier been taped telling an undercover reporter that he hired Blackkeef, recanted this in a testimony to the UK Parliament, saying, quote, "I was mistaken. We have never worked with Blackkeef." Blackkeef has denied ever working for Cambridge Analytica or its parent company and affiliates, and says it has never had a Nigeria-related project. On their website, Blackkeef promotes itself in very creative ways. Cutting-edge analytical and research skills are at the heart of every solid intelligence project. Highly experienced and trained in Israel's elite military and governmental intelligence units, the Blackkeef team uses creative and inventive thinking to connect the dots. They do harvesting in the cyber world. Blackkeef has developed innovative tools and methodologies to handle massive amounts of data. We unearth useful information for our clients and map all potential sources of interest by trawling the deep web and harvesting information from typically inaccessible areas of the internet, such as the dark net. With its multilingual background, including more than 30 native speakers of different languages, and a unique understanding of many local cultures, the team is uniquely skilled to operate in Europe, the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, Latin America, and many other regions, while handling various cultural challenges. Blackkeef has already operated successfully in over 70 countries. We have unique experience accessing and analyzing information on various platforms, including more than 240 limited access financial, commercial, regulatory, legal, and technical databases, gaining lawful access to new resources in accordance with our clients' needs. We overcome limited access sources by taking a can-do, dynamic approach. We have developed several unique methods, especially in the social engineering field, that allow us to move freely in and to extract valuable information from limited access sources, both in virtual and physical environments. We only use human intelligence to discover the truth and always act lawfully in each jurisdiction in which we operate. We do not undertake any projects involving a violent crime of any kind, including sexual harassment. We never use intimidation, blackmail, or hacking to obtain information. And we only ever record conversations that we're a party to. We do not put words into people's mouths, and our recordings are never edited to change the meaning of a conversation. Bullshit. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. Unedited transcripts of our recordings are always provided to the court. Finding leverage in complex multi-jurisdiction litigations by identifying conflicts, corruption, or fraud is part of their offerings. Quote, "One of our primary services is litigation and conflict support. We apply the full scope of our intelligence information collection, analysis, and operational skills to assist our clients in promoting their business and legal interests. We help our clients adopt a proactive approach to litigation and conflict resolution by providing intelligence that can be later used as evidence in court, while conducting closed-room negotiations. or with any other third party or authority. Information of this type critically affects the strategy and advice that our clients receive from their lawyers and other advisors. We offer active involvement in our clients' efforts to establish the evidential foundation of their cases. Using unique collection skills, we work together with our clients' legal teams, providing them with relevant materials and reports on specific areas of interest to help the legal team promote our clients' interests. Evidence collection also includes identifying and locating potential witnesses and assistance in assessing the strength of adversaries, evidence, and asset structure.
Grounded in Black Cube's in-depth familiarity with relevant legislation and court procedures related to asset recovery, our asset tracing and enforcement support services produce valuable intelligence and due diligence at a standard far beyond other currently available services. Black Cube has developed unique expertise as asset recovery practitioners, and we can function in different jurisdictions under different legal systems, extending all the way to analyzing offshore companies and trusts. Understanding your opponent is a key element when building a strategy for a complex situation. Black Cube supports litigation processes by identifying your opponent's vulnerabilities, interests, priorities, and strategy. Using our unique intelligence methodology, Black Cube enhances its clients' decision-making by providing otherwise unobtainable information. We help our clients identify their adversaries' sensitive points or vulnerabilities, or evidence of their misconduct. Drawing on our experience of fraud investigation and analyzing complex, often offshore company structures, Black Cube identifies instances of criminality in our clients' counterparties' operations, such as VAT fraud, involvement with organized crime, or sanctions violations. We then work closely with our clients in order to ensure that the information is used to maximum effect, be it by appealing to regulatory authorities, or by bringing criminal or civil actions in cases such as fraud, bribery, or terror financing. They proceed to explain their abilities to tackle corporate intelligence and financial intelligence. Cyber intelligence seems to be one of their strong points. Quote, providing an active layer of defense against cyber attacks, data leakage, and other threats to organizations, whilst robust defense systems are an essential foundation for any cybersecurity plan. It is necessary in today's fast-moving world of technology and diverse cyber threats to expand the perimeter of security in order to sufficiently safeguard your systems and data. Possession of up-to-date intelligence that allows you to know what to expect in case of an attack, and that provides an ample forewarning to prepare, is the key to an effective response system. Furthermore, swift response and forensic investigation following a cybersecurity breach can reduce exposure, recover data, and allow for a swift and appropriate recalibration of security measures. Oftentimes, Black Cube's clients find their reputation under online attack from adversaries operating anonymously or under an assumed identity. The statements made virtually in blogs, news article comments, and on social media can have a very real effect on the reputation of an individual or company. Black Cube unmasks negative campaigns aimed at slandering its clients, including the identities, biases, motivations, and conflicts of those making false statements, enabling the clients to take steps to silence them. Perhaps the greatest risk of data leakage comes from a company's own employees, be it intentional or accidental. Black Cube works with the client to identify employees that have the potential to leak or have leaked information through social media or other inadvertent methods of distribution. Coupled with an assessment of employee satisfaction in the highest risk positions, such as IT security officers, this provides the client with a strategic map for dealing with potential data leakage, enabling a swift and appropriate response. As a premium service, clients with greater security needs may retain Black Cube to be their eyes and ears in the world of cybercrime by assigning teams that actively engage with the hacker community to keep a 24/7 watch for direct threats to a specific client.
Black Cube is able to create a 360-degree picture of threats to the client's infrastructure, using their innovative methodology of obtaining information. Black Cube personnel provide real-time bulletins of any critical threat information that is relevant to the client. In today's digital age, the provenance and authenticity of computerized information can be a critical factor in deciding the facts of a case. Black Cube's cyber forensics team delves deep into metadata, the DNA of digital information, in order to show when documents have been altered or manipulated, provide clues as to the existence of further information that could be discoverable, and establish timelines and patterns of behavior. Furthermore, Black Cube's cyber forensics experts have the necessary experience and credentials to act as expert witnesses when required. Now, as you can see, in order to know how they operate and their total lack of integrity, it's necessary to review the Harvey Weinstein case and how he got involved with this intelligence agency because of his contacts with Mossad. The following is an article known as the Black Cube Chronicles, The Private Investigators, how two operatives tasked with surveilling reporters became embroiled in an international plot to suppress sexual assault allegations against Harvey Weinstein. It was written by Ronan Farrow on October 7, 2019. On a cold day in late 2016, two men sat in a corner at Nargis Cafe, an Uzbek and Russian restaurant in Shepshit Bay, Brooklyn. The place was decorated with tchotchkes, from the steeps and ceramic depictions of peasant life, grandmas in babushkas, and farmers with sheep. On a tiled wall nearby, a blue and white evil eye hung on a string. One of the men was Russian, the other Ukrainian. Both were born in the disintegrating Soviet Union. Roman Kakin, the Russian, was short and trim and bald, with a snub nose and dark eyes. Everything else about him was pale. His eyebrows were thin, his face was bloodless. He was originally from the city of Kislovodsk, whose name translates to sour waters. Igor Ostrovsky, the Ukrainian, was taller and a little fat. He had curly hair that got unruly when he let it grow out. He and his family had fled to the United States in the early 90s. Ostrovsky was curious and sometimes meddlesome. During high school, he'd suspected that several classmates were selling stolen credit card numbers and had helped law enforcement disrupt the operation. Kakin and Ostrovsky spoke in accented English and lived with Russian idioms. Krasavchik, Kakin would often say, a word derived from handsome but used to praise a job well done. Both men were in the business of subterfuge and surveillance. In 2011, Ostrovsky, a private investigator, had found himself between jobs. He'd googled Russian private investigators and then cold emailed Kakin, who had a company called Infotactic, to ask for work. Kakin liked Ostrovsky's chutzpah and started hiring him from surveillance jobs. They were meeting at Nargis to discuss potential work. As plates of kebab arrived, Kakin explained that he had started working as a subcontractor for a new client, a firm that he wouldn't name, but that was bringing in big business. Quote, I'm into some cool shit, quote, Kakin said. Some dark stuff. He'd adopted some new tactics, too. He could get bank records and unauthorized credit reports. He had ways of tracking a phone's geolocation data. He said that the phone hijinks usually cost a few $1,000. With cheaper options for gullible marks and more expensive ones for those who proved elusive. Kakin said that he'd already used the tracking method successfully for a case in which one family member had hired him to find another. Ostrovsky assumed that Kakin was exaggerating, but he needed work. And Kakin, it turned out, needed more manpower to serve his new patron. In October of 2016, as reporters circled allegations of sexual assault and harassment against the film producer Harvey Weinstein, Weinstein and his lawyers hired Black Cube, an Israeli private intelligence agency. At first, according to sources close to the Black Cube operation, The agency believed that it had been hired to counter a negative campaign against Weinstein and expected that the work would concentrate on his business rivals. But the agency soon began to receive assignments to spy on women with sexual harassment and assault accusations against Weinstein, and reporters investigating those accusations. Blacky, whose staff included former members of Mossad and other Israeli intelligence and military agencies, specialized in deception, including the use of front companies and operatives with false identities. Weinstein always denied the allegations of non-consensual sex. However, he's in prison now, in Rikers, New York. Hiring the agency was only a part of Weinstein's larger effort to prevent the disclosure of sexual abuse claims. He also hired the private investigation firm co-founded by Jack Palladino, who was best known for working to undermine women who had accused former President Bill Clinton of sexual misconduct. As part of its work for Weinstein, Palladino's firm created dossiers on both journalists and accusers. Under the guise of assembling research for a book about his company, Weinstein also hired some of his former employees to compile a list of targets and then contact the people on those lists. The list included reporters at The New Yorker, The New York Times, and New York Magazine. The actresses Rose McGowan, Rosanna Arquette, and Annabella Sciorra, and secondary sources who might be able to confirm those women's stories. But Blacky played the largest role in Weinstein's efforts to suppress the stories. Weinstein shared the list of targets with the Israeli agency, which forwarded them to a network of operatives around the world. The New Yorker previously reported that those operatives included a journalist whom the agency hired and a dedicated spy who posed under multiple false identities to gain access to journalists and accusers. Blacky also hired Kakin and Ostrovsky as subcontractors and asked them to surveil people on target lists. Farrow wrote a series of pieces on Weinstein and his enablers in the fall of 2017. During the time, he was working as a correspondent, and later he was transferred to the offices of The New Yorker. At one point, Kakin claimed to have successfully used Farrow's cell phone to track his location. A source close to the Blacky operation said that the agency was unaware of and didn't authorize the cell phone tracking. The two men also performed counter-surveillance, making sure that Blacky operatives weren't followed to meetings, which often took place in hotel lobbies or upscale restaurants in Manhattan. At those meetings, Ostrovsky would order meals, a perk of the job, while discreetly eavesdropping and recording the encounters. Some of the meetings he monitored were all related to Weinstein and concerned far-flung locations, including Cyprus, Luxembourg, and Russia. For Ostrovsky, much of the work was shrouded in mystery. The layers of command meant that he didn't know why he was following his targets or for whom. Ostrovsky had spent most of his career as a private investigator on more mundane jobs, digging up dirt for custody cases, uncovering evidence of insurance fraud, or spying on cheating spouses. The early months of 2017, after he resumed working for Kakin, were dominated by these kinds of assignments, for which he was paid $35 an hour plus expenses. That summer, however, Kakin began giving Ostrovsky assignments that came from the anonymous new client. Kakin said little about these jobs. Sometimes he will send screenshots of documents that featured the addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, and biographical information of targets. Often the screenshots included information on spouses and other family members. Although Ostrovsky didn't know it, the information was pulled from dossiers that Blacky had compiled for Harvey Weinstein. In the summer of 2017, Farrow was speaking to Weinstein's accusers and colleagues. Ostrovsky and Kakin began meeting at dawn near his apartment building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Some days, they would stay in Kakin's car, a silver Nissan Pathfinder. Other times, the two would use separate cars. Kakin would be ready to follow me if I left the building, and Ostrovsky would keep an eye on my apartment. When separated, they stayed in touch by text. The investigators had been given photos of Farrow and had done database searches of their own. They monitor his social media accounts and those of his friends and relatives, trying to track his movements. The pair sat in front of his building, chain-smoking and getting bagels from a restaurant around the corner. The surveillance often dragged on for hours, and there were few opportunities for bathroom breaks. Kahin and Ostrovsky sometimes disagreed about how best to conduct the surveillance, bickering in their texts and calls, under the impression that Farrow was on the Today Show one morning, and assuming that he would be at the Rockefeller Center, where the show tapes. At times, the investigators were helpless. One day, Ostrovsky and Kahin spotted one of his neighbors, to whom Farrow bore a passing resemblance, coming out of his apartment building. They gave a chase, Ostrovsky followed by car filming on a Panasonic camcorder, and Kahin pursued on foot. On a later day, when Ostrovsky was alone on duty, he followed the same man again, drawing near enough to touch him, sensing that something was wrong. Ostrovsky dialed Farrow's number. Upstairs, in Farrow's apartment, he picked up the call from a number he didn't recognize. "Hello," he said, and heard the brief exclamation in Russian before the line went dead. He put down the phone, confused and unnerved. Downstairs, his neighbor walked on, unaware that Ostrovsky had been following him. Farrow wasn't the only one Ostrovsky and Kahin were following. They also built a few hours trailing Jody Cantor, a reporter from the Times, who was also working on a story about Weinstein, on one occasion taking photographs of her as she commuted to work on the subway. One morning, in August of 2017, Kahin called Ostrovsky and told him that they would be relying on a new surveillance tactic. Ostrovsky thought of Kahin's boast the previous fall that he had that means to obtain a phone's geolocation data. Shortly after noon that day, Kahin started sending Ostrovsky screenshots of maps marked with pin drops indicating the latitude, longitude, and elevation of a moving target. Kahin seemed to have found a way to track Farrow's phone. The information that Kahin sent to Ostrovsky was correct. That day, Farrow was at the World Trade Center for his first meeting with David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, to discuss the reporting on Weinstein that the magazine would eventually publish. Farrow was on edge. In the preceding weeks, he'd begun to suspect that he was being followed. His building superintendent had told him that he'd seen men lurking outside. Sources had advised him to get a gun and move out of the apartment. On the day of that meeting, hundreds of text messages flooded his phone. Each came from a different number. He swiped away the text, then finally gave up and responded to opt out, which seemed not to help. In the same time frame, unbeknownst to him, Kahin was sending Ostrovsky the maps, accurately pinpointing his location. He left the meeting at the New Yorker feeling anxious, suspecting that he'd been followed on the subway in the past. Farrow decided to hail a cab as he made his way uptown. He went right by Kahin and Ostrovsky, who were waiting near the New Yorker's office, hoping to intercept him. The article continues to express the different ways and manners in which Ronan Farrow was surveilled, stalked, and harassed by these Black Youth operatives. During Black Youth Intelligence Part 2, we will review more about Weinstein and the case itself and how he got in contact with this so-called Black Youth Intelligence. I just wanted to mention, I was forced to take a break for my mental health. Honestly, these weeks have been the hardest since I started doing this, not only because of this election's madness and all the stress that it's supposed to create, because guys, let's be honest, Trump or no Trump, whatever you believe about him, this election disaster is basically a trauma-based mind control event. They're not only trying to destroy your hopes in democracy, they're also trying to make you fight with your family, your neighbors, your friends. The main purpose is to divide us more than we already are. Sadly, as I watch the disgusting animals of Antifa and Black Lives Matter attacked innocent Trump supporters during the rally in D.C. last weekend. I mean, how can you not take sides, guys? I understand. I was a liberal for most of my life. Of course, I had libertarian ideals, but I was essentially a liberal. Now I'm a libertarian with conservative leaning. But guys, when you see people sucker punching old people, elderly women, families with children, being harassed, being punched, being robbed, being insulted, being threatened, they throw liquids at them. Who knows what it's in those liquids? Most likely is urine or some other disgusting currents. But I was forced to just disconnect. I mean, I always check my messages and my emails. I don't disconnect entirely. But I just needed a break. I just couldn't handle the stress. And you know, when I'm not in a good state of mind, it's very hard for me to appear on camera or even on radio, because I don't want to be a downer. I'm not really good at disguising my actual feelings. I'm a very frontal guy, and that's the way I like to be, and that's the way I like to handle myself, for better or for worse. So my apologies for that. I'll catch up, record this episode tomorrow, and then I'll start the Monica Peterson episodes, and then Isaac Cappies. I think this week we will cover 6 or 7 episodes, so we'll see how it goes, guys. In the meanwhile, thank you for supporting Total Disclosure. It's much obliged and much necessary. Now that we have been 100% banned from Facebook, by the way, they also deleted my video of Louder Than Love because I guess it shows Biden being a pedophile. But now that our reach is less, we need to pay for other services, pay for other ways to communicate with people, whatever the cost is. I cannot let the truth in hands of people like Alex Jones or, you know, Q or whatever it is. I don't trust those movements as much as I trust myself. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. I don't know if there are psychological operations. Well, actually, I do know, but I don't want to force my opinion on you guys. So, have a nice day, and we'll talk later.